So I'll get started. I thought I'd talk about two projects that are underway in my group right now that have no relation to each other, but I thought that it might still be of interest in the workshop. The first one will be dealing with a new way of measuring the dynamics of spins in magnetic structures, essentially a new way of doing ferromagnetic resonance on samples much smaller than other ferromagnetic resonance techniques. And I hope actually, I'll show you results on devices about 100 nanometers in diameter. I hope this technique will be extendable to much smaller length scales as well. And I'll tell you why that should work. And the second part of the talk is actually related to something we heard about this morning with gallium manganese arsenide. We've been doing experiments on ferromagnetic break junctions, working to make them very mechanically stable, and then looking at measuring their resistance in large fields so that the moments are saturated, but as a function of the angle of the applied magnetic field. And we do see a large, essentially tunneling anisotropic magnetoresistance field, even in the samples, qualitatively similar to what's been seen in gallium manganese arsenide. But I'll argue that the mechanism is probably slightly different. I think we have a good idea of the mechanism now. So to get started, I want to just give a quick review of spin transfer torques. We've heard a good deal about these through the workshop, so I won't really spend much time at all, but just to review, I'll be dealing with the flavor of spin transfer torque experiments involving multilayers, and so we'll be sending spin polarized currents perpendicularly to incident on thin magnetic layers. And the original theory of John Slonczewski and a slightly different theory of Luc Berger turns out describes our results very well, and that you can think about what happens when a spin polarized current is incident on a magnetic layer as, at least to first order, the transverse angular momentum from the spin polarized current will get absorbed in the layer and it can feel a torque. And the mechanism can be thought of very simply. As individual electrons come into the layer, they'll process around the exchange field and move along. Different electrons traveling on different paths will process, will spend different amounts of time in the magnet. Their spin precession will get out of phase. And when you sum over everything, eventually you can think about the transverse component of spin being lost from the current and being transferred to that magnet. That's not an exact theory. In a sense, this electrons which can be reflected from layer can carry away some angular momentum as well, and so you won't completely absorb all the transverse angular momentum, and you can also get some angular momentum transfer in or out of the board as well, essentially an effective field torque. But these, at least in theory, these corrections are thought to be less than about 10% compared to the main Slonczewski torque in metal spin valves, and we'll be able to sort of see that that is indeed true. Okay, so I'll be talking just briefly about different types of torque. When I talk about Slonczewski-type torques, I'll talk about torques which will seek to move, say, a free layer magnetic moment within the plane defined by it, the free layer moment and the fixed layer moment in these sorts of bilayer spin transfer devices. That's what comes out of the simple Slonczewski theory. Whereas an effective field type of torque I'll talk about is something that will want to move the free layer in or out of the board here, essentially make it want to process around the fixed layer rather than shift closer to or farther away from it. And importantly for the results, the Slonczewski type torque, the direction of it will depend on the sign of the current. One sign of current will want to push the moments closer together. The other sign of the other sign of current will want to push the free layer away from the fixed layer. And so there are different types of dynamics that can result then. And at least in terms of thinking about a simple macrospin description, you can think about things actually in a fairly simple picture. The basic idea of when you get spin transfer-induced excitations is when the current has the right sign and it's of a large enough magnitude that the spin transfer torque can overcome the effective damping torque that's present in the material. And that means instead of spiraling toward the effective field direction as a magnet out of equilibrium will normally do, you can, with spin transfer, you can get it to spiral away from the effective field direction and excite excitations that way. And at least qualitatively, there's two different types of excitations that can result. One is that the free layer can spiral away from the field direction, spiral larger and larger, and eventually just spiral all the way to 180 degrees and end up in a reverse state. And so this will give us switching between two static magnetic states. And then by reversing the current, it's actually possible to switch it backward to make a nice bistable element. The other thing that can happen qualitatively is you can have situations, especially at larger applied magnetic fields, where as you increase the current, you get an instability, the moment begins to spiral away, but it can reach a state of a dynamic equilibrium at a certain precession angle where the energy gained from the spin transfer can equal the energy lost from the damping. And so you can just sort of apply a DC current and sit there and spiral and process around at some gigahertz or tens of gigahertz frequencies due to this effect as well. So you can make steady state precession that way. And both of these qualitative type effects have been seen. So I'll be talking about various kinds of pillar devices today. Most of what I talk about will be metal spin valves, for instance, taking two permalloy layers with a copper spacer in between. We certainly see switching and precession in those devices. We can also see both switching and precession in tunnel junctions as well. If you make a thin aluminum oxide or magnesium oxide layer thin enough, you can get enough synchronized current through it to excite these spin transfer dynamics even in a tunnel junction. Okay. And this is what the precession looks like in both a frequency domain and in a time domain measurement. And actually, by fiddling around with samples, we've been able to get the quality of precession quite high. You can get line widths in these pillar samples on the order of one part in 2,000. And the NIST group, using a different device geometry of point contact, so they excited a domain within an extended film, they can get even narrower line widths, nearly one part in 20,000 or so of the line width of precession. Okay, so that's a bit of a review. That's what happens when you apply DC currents to these devices. My first subject today is essentially what happens if you apply either just an AC microwave current to devices or combinations of microwave currents and DC devices. And you'll see to be able to do essentially a ferromagnetic resonance experiment this way. And so the samples here are very similar to what I talked about before, two magnetic layers with a metal spacer in between. We use permalloy for the thicker, essentially fixed magnetic layer. And for these experiments, we've used a different material, a permalloy copper alloy for the free layer, so that we have different magnetic moment densities in the two layers. What that allows us to do is then by applying a perpendicular magnetic field, we can turn the moments in these layers out of the plane to different extents and have a non-zero equilibrium angle between the moments without any current applied. And the simplest regime to work with is to apply a large enough field to actually saturate the permalloy copper moment out of plane and have this perpendicular, and then the permalloy layer will just be tilted a few degrees out of plane because it has a larger moment, a larger Dmag field. Okay. So what that equilibrium angle allows us to do is to have a non-zero torque. It allows us to control the torque. It has a non-zero torque from the beginning. Whereas if we start out with moments parallel to each other, we have to rely on some thermal fluctuation or something to give us a non-zero torque to allow the instabilities to begin. Okay, so what does the experiment consist of? Well, it's very simple. All we do is apply an AC, a microwave current, and measure the DC voltage coming out of the sample. And this will allow us to measure the ferromagnetic resonance. And it works very simply. So first of all, how do we excite the precession? Well, if we apply an AC current to this device, what the spin transfer does is want to push the free layer moment either toward the fixed layer moment or away from it. And so if we apply the microwave signal at the right frequency, we can excite the precession through that way. So the precession will be excited in this experiment, not by applying an AC magnetic field, as is normally done in ferromagnetic resonance experiments, but by applying an AC current and using the spin transfer torque to excite the precession. That's fine, so you can get precession that way. How do you detect it? Well, it turns out that comes for free just due to simple mathematics. So it's simple enough to actually write out. If the moment starts to precess, you'll get a changing resistance due to the GMR effect, and so you'll have a time-dependent resistance. If you think about what the voltage across the device is, Ohm's law works just fine. You have a time-dependent current times a time-dependent resistance, one cosine from the current, another cosine from the resistance. And if you just think about that cosine squared term, you can think about that as giving both a DC term and a 2 omega term. This is a trig relationship. And so the experiment just consists of sweeping the frequency of the applied AC current through any resonances in the sample, measuring the DC voltage, and if you hit a resonance, you'll get an extra DC resistance signal across the sample that you can measure easily that way. And this is very useful in the sense that this kind of swept frequency measurement allows you to use all the tricks that people have developed for ferromagnetic resonance for learning about magnetic dynamics. in ways that I'll describe to you. And being able to measure the resonance through a DC technique rather than an AC technique, it's very nice from an experimental point of view. Whenever you're trying to detect sort of a high frequency signal in these kinds of resonance experiments, you always have to worry about impedance matching, and typically the impedance of the devices aren't well matched to sort of 50 ohm transmission lines you use for transmitting microwaves out, and so you lose a lot of signal through the impedance matching that way. You don't have those effects if you sort of do a DC detection this way. You still have impedance matching problems for, you know, getting the applied microwave power in to excite the resonances, but you can always amplify the power you put in. You can always get more of that. It's harder to amplify small signals and get the output that way. So how does this work? Well, this is essentially just the raw data, just the DC voltage across the sample normalized by the square of the RF current. That's the way the signal scales. And I show the data here for three different magnetic fields. And for each magnetic field, I show the signal for different small DC biases. So the lowest curve on each triplet corresponds to zero DC current, and then sort of increasing small DC currents below the critical current for exciting dynamics. And I do that well. You can see that what the DC current does is change the effect of magnetic damping for some of the modes. And so by doing that, you can change the width and make some of the modes easier to see if you apply the small DC current. And I'll describe how that works in just a moment. Okay. So what you see is you see lots of dips and bumps in the curves as you go along. And if you just take the different curves, measure different magnetic fields, and plot out how those dips and bumps evolve with field, you get this sort of diagram. And I've color-coded things here. We're able to disentangle which layer a mode is associated with from the magnetic field dependence and from the sign of the signal, whether it's a dip or a bump, and from the dependence of the widths on the DC current. And so we do see signals from both of the magnetic layers. Both of the free layer and the fixed layer can be moved. If you apply the RF current at the frequency that corresponds to some mode of that layer, you can get it to be excited. And we're able to identify, first of all, the modes labeled in red here as being associated with the thinner free chromo-y copper layer. The easiest way to make that identification is that above the coercive field or the DMAG field of that layer, which is about 0.3 Tesla, those curves just go linearly with field with a G factor right around 2, which is what you expect for these layers. And they're just based off one another. Whereas the other two main modes here have a slower dependence on magnetic field, which makes sense for modes corresponding to the thicker Pomeroy layer, because it's not saturated out of field by these magnetic fields, and so it's more slowly tilting out of plane, and you have a weaker magnetic field dependence because of that. Another way of being able to identify the different modes is, first of all, you see one very clear dip mode here. You see a negative response in the resonance. That's to be expected for the lowest order fixed layer mode because of the dependence of the sine of the torque on the sine of current in these devices. Essentially what goes on there is the motion of the fixed layer for positive currents will be pushed toward the free layer mode in these devices, giving a decrease in current, which if you work through the mixing will give you a negative signal. Whereas the lowest order mode for the fixed layer, for positive currents, will be pushed away from the fixed layer mode, increasing the resistance and giving a positive signal. So you can learn about things that way as well. Also, because of this dependence of the sine of the torque on the sine of the current, the damping will be decreased for positive currents for the free layer modes, making these modes sharper in a resonance experiment. And so you'll see that all of the modes I've labeled in red get narrower as I go up to positive current here, showing that I am decreasing their effective damping.
The role of the nanomagnet is just to give you a
monodomain. That's one role. The other role is that it simplifies the analysis devices if the real magnetic field generated by the current is a small effect. As you get larger devices, that scales to the magnetic field is more important. And it will be an important question whether the magnet is responding as a single domain or whether you have some more complicated dynamics. But I will speak to that shortly as well. Okay, so in that I'll speak to it now, actually. So what are these normal modes? We haven't done the detailed micromagnetic calculations that we need to yet for our particular geometry, but a geometry close to ours was calculated by Bob McMichael and Mark Stiles, just with an in-plane magnetic field rather than out-of-plane magnetic field. And they calculate that the various normal modes in the magnetic layer essentially correspond to drum head modes with different numbers of lines of nodes horizontally and vertically. The lowest order mode is the one that corresponds to the most uniform precession, but it's not exactly uniform. You tend to get a bit of a larger angle precession near the ends than you do in the middle of the device. And then the higher frequency modes corresponds to essentially shorter wavelength spin waves. In terms of comparisons, the measured frequencies and frequency spacings are in reasonable agreement with the simulation for what we measure. But we really do need to, I think it will not be hard to do an exact comparison with a perpendicular magnetic field. So we're starting to work on that. These are the linear response modes, the small amplitude modes.
But you are not always in that region.
We can tune between the small amplitude mode and the higher amplitude mode. I'll talk about that. But the smallest angles we can measure, at least for the fundamental modes, correspond to about 0.2 degree precession angles. And the largest ones we've measured before, you'll see about 40 degrees. So we can go within that range. Okay. So what is this useful for? Well, you can do a lot of the same things that people do with standard Fermi-Rank resonance measurements. One thing you can do, for instance, is look at the peak widths. And the peak widths in a resonance measurement are determined by damping. And so this gives you a direct way of measuring the damping in a nanometer scale sample, which there have been ways of doing this before, but they've been rather tedious. The best way has been to look at switching statistics as a function of the height and width of various DC pulses, and then fit to a model to try to work out what the damping is that can describe the statistics. And that takes a week's worth of data and analysis, which is a little bit shaky. But here you can do it within a few seconds. You can just measure a nice resonance. And this is important because if you're worried about things like the switching current in a magnetic device this way, that's determined by the amount of spin transfer torque you need to overcome the damping. And so the damping presence in the device, you want to be able to control that and reduce that as much as possible. And so this shows a close-up view of the fundamental mode of the free layer in our devices, the thermal copper mode. It's a function of frequency. The peak shape is a nice Lorentzian. And if you take the width of that peak, that translating that into sort of magnetic units, it gives a damping of about 0.04 for this device. You can compare that to the damping you see in bilayers or spin valve structures fabricated simultaneously with ours and just not put through the nanofabrication process to make the pillars, so just large area planes of films. Those actually have lower damping, about 0.02, measured by standard FMR techniques. And so one of the things we're worrying about now is why do the nanofabricated structures have larger damping? We don't really know, but we have some ideas. In particular, one of the things that happens during the process of nanofabrication is these devices are exposed to air, and there's opportunity then for anti-Fermi-Rank oxides to form around the sides of the pillar. And we're worried that those will couple to the Fermi-Rank mode and provide energy loss pathways to increase the damping. So we're trying to figure out how to do the fabrication without air exposure now. You can also study how the damping depends on the DC current. As I said, one thing that happens with DC current is that gives a torque that, at least on average, can either act parallel to or anti-parallel to the damping. And so a DC current can change the effect of damping in these kinds of devices. And we see that directly in the FMR measurements, which would be a nice linear dependence of the FMR resonance width on the DC current. And actually, if you extrapolate where the damping goes to zero, if it predicted to go to zero, where you cause the instability to have the DC-driven excitations turn on, and this is where we see the DC-driven excitation start. So that simple Sanzuski picture, again, holds very nicely. One other nice thing in terms of making practical devices is if you're interested in making resonators with very high quality factors, this is a device where you can, with an external parameter, control the quality factor and make it as high as you want. You can turn the damping down essentially to zero in these devices and have a very high quality precessional oscillation. Another thing you can do, studying as a function of DC current, is ask how the resonance frequency changes. And it doesn't change much. Here it just changes by less than 1% as you turn the current from zero all the way up to the critical current for making the DC-driven excitations. And what that means, in terms of the theory of the spin transfer effects, is that really it is a good approximation to think about the dominant torque from the current as being the Sanzuski-type torque that acts in the plane of the two moments and devices without much of an effective field torque from the current that would act in the perpendicular direction. The effective field torque, because it is an effective field, would change the precession frequency of the devices and make it precess at some other frequency. In terms of setting limits, from this sort of data, if you assume that all the current dependence here is due to an effective field type torque term, which is actually doubtful because the current can change angles, change exchange fields, and things like that slightly. But making that assumption, that would say the effective field torque is less than 50% of the Sanzuski torque. So on the order of what's been predicted by theory. And that's not really a surprise. There's another way of measuring the effective field torque that Andy Kent's group wrote a nice paper about, based on the analysis of the current field phase diagrams, essentially what the slopes of the lines in the phase diagram are. And they found that the effective field term was, I think, less than 20% of the Sanzuski type terms in that kind of analysis as well. And that reference is given there. Okay. So that's what happens to the resonance as a function of DC current. You can also ask what happens as a function of changing the amplitude of the RF current, this is what Jared asked. And this is some data shown here. We can use small enough currents and have good enough signal noise to be in the linear response regime where the width of the, we just have a nice Lorentzian peak width. The width doesn't depend on the amplitude of the RF current within the range. And the amplitude scales, as you'd expect, with the square of the RF current, which is what you expect from a simple analysis. However, you can also turn the RF current up higher and higher, and eventually you see strong nonlinearities. You see a stiffening of the resonances, that the peak resonance will shift to higher frequency as you turn up the amplitude of the drive. And that's not an unexpected thing. These are nonlinear oscillators. That's the sort of thing that nonlinear oscillators do. And actually, the source of the nonlinearity can be understood in a simple way as well, because, it's just this. Essentially, you have a strong dependence of the DMAG field on the amplitude of the precession, which will influence the precession frequency. What I mean by that is for small precession angles, essentially the average moment just stays perpendicular to the plane. So there's a strong DMAG field, which acts opposite the effective field, opposite the applied field. So the total effective field is rather small, and that's what determines the precession frequency. However, as you go to a larger precession angle, now the DMAG field is smaller. The total, that gives a smaller subtraction from the applied field, so the total effective field is larger, and that means you've got a larger effective field, a larger precession frequency. And that does sort of at least agree qualitatively with the kind of macro spin simulations we've done. From the amount of the shift in frequency here, you can get an estimate about what's the biggest precession angle you can induce with this effect. And the largest we've seen is about 40 degrees, which is in something of a contrast with bulk ferromagnetic resonance measurements. There, due to instabilities degenerating shorter wavelength magnons, there's something called the Sewell instability, which causes you not to be able to tilt a moment larger than about 2 or 3 degrees with the standard ferromagnetic resonance measurements. I think this is showing that the nature of the energy loss processes and the types of instabilities you see at large angle are different in these sort of nanostructure samples and in the larger samples. And I think that will be something that will be interesting to study in the future. Another question that's been of considerable debate in the community of spin transfer is what are the type of modes that are driven once you start seeing microwave oscillations under a DC-driven current. Our initial modeling was always done just assuming a simple macrospin approximation, because essentially that's all we knew how to do. But Pete Bauer and his collaborators, and also Mark Stiles and his collaborators, have predicted that you can get various kinds of transverse instabilities that can excite shorter wavelength modes as well. And these have been seen in single magnetic layers in Andy Kent's group. But one nice thing with having the ferromagnetic resonance technique available is we know where all the modes are now, at least all the low frequency modes. And so we can compare two DC-driven experiments and just see what frequency of modes we're seeing, which mode they correspond to. So that's shown here. These are the DC-driven processional signals from the same sample we measured the FMR samples on. And the experiment here is just to apply a DC current and just hook the device to a spectrum analyzer and see what kind of microwaves it's emitting. So it's a very direct, simple experiment. If you do that and tune the current up, you see no microwaves for low currents beyond a threshold, the critical current, you start seeing some precession again. And in this device, that initial precession corresponds to just a little bit less than 8 gigahertz here. Comparing to the FMR measurements, you can see that that does match up very well with the current of the lowest frequency free layer excitation mode. And so we can say, at least for this sample, that the instability, the first mode that's excited, is the most uniform mode, that lowest frequency mode.
What's the origin of the blue shape?
The origin of the what?
Of the blue shape.
So here I'm going up to larger currents, and what this mode is doing is you're getting larger amplitude precession, and again, it's just that nonlinear I was talking about before. You go up to higher precession frequencies that way. The other thing that happens as you go up to larger currents is eventually you can start exciting other modes too. And this has been something that's been a little bit mysterious in previous experiments. You'll often turn the current and see little jumps in your frequency and things will go along. We can, by reading the comparisons now, we can say that these jumps and these other frequencies do correspond to higher lying free layer modes that we can see in the FMR experiments too. And sometimes you actually see mode hopping. You can see the excitation of the higher frequency non-uniform mode, while you don't see excitation of the uniform mode too. So the details there will depend on the experiment and be a little bit complicated. Okay. One thing you'll notice in this graph is if you look at what happens in the FMR measurements for large DC currents above the critical current for excitations, is you'll see large changes in peak shape. You'll go to kind of a sigmoid or derivative type shape rather than a simple Lorentzian. And we think we understand that as well. What happens there in that regime is you don't have a simple thermic resonance experiment anymore, but you have the applied AC current interacting with a pre-existing oscillation, which is there because you're applying a large DC current, and in a DC current the free layer possesses around. And so it's more of a phase locking picture than a simple FMR picture. So basically the picture is this sort of thing. If you have no AC drive and just a large DC-driven excitation, a DC current, what you have is just the DC-driven excitation, just a simple precession like that, already going on at some particular frequency. If you now have that existing and start applying an AC current as well, you'll only see a mixing signal, a DC-driven signal, is if that natural oscillation locks to the applied AC signal, and you get a mixing signal that way. So what happens is you sweep an applied AC current near that natural resonance frequency, is you'll get a phase locking. And the phase of the phase locking can be either in phase or out of phase, depending on whether you have a frequency above or below the natural resonance frequency. So if you have a higher frequency AC drive in our samples, that corresponds to a larger precession angle than the natural resonance angle. And so that corresponds to pushing out to larger angles. It turns out that that's an in-phase oscillation in the phase locking, and so that will give a positive mixing signal. However, if you apply a frequency at lower than the natural resonance frequency, but strong enough to have phase locking, what happens there is because the lower frequency excitations correspond to a smaller precession angle than the natural precession angle, you actually phase lock 180 degrees out of phase and get a negative mixing signal. So that can explain why you have a sign change in the mixing signal as you sweep through the resonance. And this does also come out in the macrospin simulation. Okay, so just prior to where we sent our preprint out, a similar experiment was done in Japan by Tulip Parker et al. It's a slightly different device, but pretty much the same idea as what we're doing. Instead of a metallic spin valve, they were looking at a tunnel junction. So with a cobalt iron boron free layer, a magnesium oxide tunnel junction between the free layer and the magnetic underlayer, and then their fixed magnetic layer was a composite structure, a synthetic antiferromagnet that consisted of a couple of cobalt iron boron layers with the ruthenium spacer. Sort of a standard trick within the magnetic memory community. They also did experiments at room temperature, and used a different geometry than we did. They did an in-plane geometry where they applied the field in-plane but about 30 degrees from the z-axis of their samples. And what they saw resonance signals, but one interesting thing was they saw a different peak shape than what we saw. These are at zero DC current, where we just saw simple Lorentzians, but they see, for low magnetic field, this sort of sigmoid-type structure, and then at large magnetic fields, actually even sort of stranger shapes, where we see sort of various kinds of more complicated non-linear time bending. So this is a very nice experiment, and I wish they hadn't done theirs before we did ours, but I think this does raise some interesting questions, which might be of interest to the theory community here. The main one being, you know, why is there this non-Lorentzian peak shape? The authors of the experimental paper had a suggestion in the paper that this might be due to a large effective field torque as well as the Sanzuski-type torque in the samples. And there's some modeling which can give these kinds of more complicated peak shapes. That's, I think, might be possible. There's been suggestions by Garrett Bauer's group and others that in tunnel junctions, because you have lots of electrons reflecting off the junction, you can get larger effective field torques compared to the Sanzuski-type torque. He's furrowing his brow, so you might not be sure about that. But this doesn't seem crazy to me. But I think what you want to do is do the same sort of experiment I showed before. Look at the precession frequency as a function of DC current in this sort of device and see if you see directly that kind of effective field. So that's something that can be probed experimentally. But there's other possibilities as well. One possibility is because they're working room temperature, they might already have some pre-existing oscillations here, just thermally driven, and you might see a phase-locking signal, as I showed, giving you this sort of more complicated sigmoid type peak. But I wouldn't know how to use phase-locking to give that the more complicated peak they see at high frequency. Another idea, which I think is probably the most likely, is they might be seeing a superposition of signals from two different modes, because depending on what layers you're talking about, you can either get negative signals on resonance or positive signals on resonance. If you see two modes close together, you might see a positive mode close to a negative one and see these sorts of signals just because you're not well separating the different modes. And there is some evidence of that as well. If you look at the DC-driven signals, sometimes there's two DC-driven peaks quite close to each other that are near where these more complicated modes are. And then a fourth idea that Garrett just suggested to me yesterday was possible you might be able to see these more complex signals if you have precessions along a precession axis that isn't parallel to one of the easy axes of anisotropy for the sample.
Alex
Kovalev. So I think that's a calculation in progress. So that might well explain this experiment, because in this experiment they do have a precession axis that's not along one of the magnetic easy axes. Okay. One other thing you might have noticed if you have sharp eyes is that the line width of the DC-driven signals can be much narrower than the line width of the FMR signals. And that's actually to be expected. The FMR signals are determined, the width is determined by the damping, at least in the regime. You have a different kind of physics going on in the DC-driven samples. There you have essentially just an auto-oscillation, and you can have an auto-oscillation that's very nicely periodic in a system with lots of damping. The width line was determined just by how much deviation from perfectly periodic behavior there is as the oscillator goes through two different cycles. So it's not hard to get narrower line widths in a DC-driven technique than in a FMR technique. But it still is a question to us, what determines the line width of DC-driven signals and why are they so narrow? They're narrower than we expect from simple models. One thing we can say experimentally is they seem to be temperature dependent. And that says that the line width is determined by thermal kicks that cause deviations from periodic behavior. And the narrowest lines appear to have something like a T to the 1/2 dependence of the line width on temperature at low temperatures, with more complicated thermally activated dependences at higher temperatures. And at least there are some simple models where you get a T to the 1/2 dependence just from simple equipartition arguments in a macro spin theory. So that's not so crazy, I think. But if you just try to apply a macro spin theory using the parameters as best we're able to estimate in our samples, we measure in some samples low temperature line widths about an order of magnitude narrower than what we'd expect from the simple models. And perhaps the conclusion there is just, well, you need better models. You should go to more realistic kind of micromagnetic theory to calculate what the line width should be. But there have been a number of groups trying to do that, and so far the micromagnetic calculations all seem to predict larger line widths in the macroscopic model, not narrower line widths. And so this, I think, is another good puzzle that I'd like to be able to get people to think about a little bit. One thing I wonder is whether something might be missing in the assumptions of the micromagnetic codes that are existing so far. In particular, I wonder about whether they take into account the nature of the interactions between the moment and the currents as well as they could. For instance, there might be interactions between different parts of the magnet mediated by the current flow. One example of this has actually been calculated in single layer magnets. The instabilities that can occur in single layers due to current flow are due to electrons scattering off one part of the magnet, traveling over the other side and applying a torque, and they can cause instabilities. I wonder if there might be ways to have them cause more stabilities in some geometries too. But anyway, I think this is another thing which might be useful to think about. Okay, so that was where I wanted to stop talking about the FMR stuff and go on and start talking about the magnetic point contacts. But if there are questions, this would be a good time for questions. Yeah?
Just another question about spin waves, for example. So is it possible that you know one example that more spin waves micromagnetic direction? I don't know how these two approaches are related to each other, but maybe you would consider some coherent excitation in the system volume, for example, some magnetization of some domain or session and so on. So,
yeah, I don't know the answer. I mean, I'm a lowly experimentalist, but I mean, what happens in these micromagnetic simulations is they divide the sample up into little cubes and, you know, have various kinds of interactions in them. But certainly the spin wave modes aren't built into those in any nice way, and they don't seem to appear in them in any nice way, and at least some of the initial calculations have been done. So I do wonder whether if you might start from a type of theory that starts with those spin waves as being essentially the low energy excitations that are built in, whether that might be a nicer way of doing it. But, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think as Dan said, spin waves can be excited if the current has a certain critical current in a single layer. In the case that you have a spin valve, you get competition, right? Because and then comes a conjugate. So you can get critical currents for homogeneous excitations of the lowest modes, but sometimes the critical currents of the spin waves can be lower than that of the homogeneous mode. Especially when you have very asymmetric structures, the spin waves can be easily excited than the others. But all these analyses are only in the linear regime. So nonlinear, nonlinear regime, everything becomes very messy.
I guess I should say the narrowest line widths and the D-strip excitations do come far into the nonlinear regime. So
I think the present micromagnetic codes cannot cope with these problems because they can take into account spin waves, but they do not take into account that you have to do the self-consistent, the current, the spin current distributions in the normal manner region as well. So you really have to sort of do the micromagnetism as well in the normal matter and the ferromagnets, if you want to describe this problem. And then I guess Dan's hypothesis that could sort of make things more coherent could well be correct.
Yeah. Is it fundamentally possible to distinguish some aspects of spin waves? Different behaviors, and if you have such a macro spin or
one thing we might be able to do is, because we can tell by comparing the DC-driven measurements and the FMR which modes are which, we can try, and we haven't done this yet, is to sort of compare systematically what type of modes have narrower or broader line widths as well. One thing in some very recent data appears also that if you get more complicated magnetic structures, for instance, a sample with a vortex in it, that that can also give very different line widths in the kind of distribution experience you see.
But you can also, of course, make direct imaging, huh? Like people in Stanford have had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was lovely.
But you said that what?
I thought that was lovely. Yeah, that was nice.
Right. Mm-hmm. But they do not see spin waves, but they see more vortex type of structures.
Yeah, well, they've been dealing with devices so far that have rather high critical currents, so the Oersted fields are more important there.
Right.
They did a run last week with smaller devices, and I haven't heard the results from yet. But so Storr, I guess, is the senior person on those experiments, and I've got the frequently in Zeeman also. Yes, I don't remember the first author that actually have frequency. Yeah, but I think that will be a very powerful technique as that develops. Yeah, so there was a talk at the kickoff conference, and so that is on the website here.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Okay, well, then for something completely different. So we'll move on now to talk about a different kind of magnetic sample, magnetic point contacts, where you try to look at devices with the smaller constriction width as you can, down to the atomic scale, and then even completely broken into the tunneling regime. And I guess the first thing to say about this field is it has somewhat of a checkered past. It's important that as I go through the rest of the talk, you have the proper skepticism as you go through. And that is, in this field, there's been quite a lot of previous work where some groups have reported extremely large effects, factors of 10,000% or so changes in resistance as they applied magnetic fields to small devices, that they coined the phrase ballistic magnetoresistance to try to describe. And there's been a good deal of the challenge and discussion about whether those effects might actually just be due to artifacts of samples breaking and rejoining due to various magnetostriction or magnetostatic forces. And so one problem throughout all the experiments in this field is really being able to work hard to make sure you have good mechanical stability, that as you, say, change magnetic field, the sample's just not moving and giving you a change of resistance for that reason. Sure. Okay.
Well, you don't, like, once in the kind of mass in the constrictions, you don't have mechanical problems.
Yes.
You do the tunneling, the
constricting, yes, so that's nice. They don't see, they might see large effects, but for different reasons there, too. I guess I should say this is still a field of open argument. The people who point this point of view are still doing more experiments and arguing their case. But at least I'm skeptical. But it's not a proven point yet, to be fair. So in terms of our experiments, we'll try to make devices as mechanically stable as we can. What that will mean is we'll do the experiments with no suspended magnetic parts. We'll try to have things stuck as securely as they can to a non-magnetic substrate. And we'll work only at low temperatures so you don't have any surface migration of atoms going around, which can easily change resistances in room temperature experiments, at least in this kind of scale. So this is the kind of experiments we'll be doing. We'll be using electromigration to make very small contacts. So we'll start out by making a magnetic bridge 100 nanometers or so across, joining two larger magnetic lozenges like this, connect up to just non-magnetic contact pads. And what we'll do is to be able to vary the size of the constriction, we'll just use a rather crude technique. We'll pass current through the device until you start to have some instabilities, atoms can move around, and you can gradually narrow the contact device that way. And then you can do that while you're monitoring resistance. You can stop the electromigration at various points and just measure the magnetic resistance properties for a particular device configuration, and then go back, electromigrate a little bit more, make a smaller contact, and keep doing over and over again. So we can look at the magnetic resistance as a function of contact size within a given sample that way. And this electromigration is something which can be done in a controlled way or can be done in a rather uncontrolled way where things just blow up. We've been trying to figure out how to make sure that we know the difference. And I think we've done that reasonably well now. We can actually do experiments where we watch the electromigration process that goes along inside a scanning electron microscope, monitor resistance at the same time, at least some test devices actually see how the electron migration process is going on. So we can tell in this kind of way that we're not in a regime where we start forming nanoparticles and having a more complicated device structure, but we really just narrow the contact down and have one narrow bridge that way.
Doesn't this work for all matrix in the same way?
Gold, especially some ones to see, just because it gives good contrast in SCM. We've done similar things with permalife, which is the material used. The pictures turn out a little bit more fuzzy, but as far as we can tell, the process goes the same way. The key to the different types of electromigration regimes seems to be using low resistance electrical contacts so that you have the right kind of feedback in terms of current or voltage biasing. And that way you can keep things from running away.
What did we see in the trim there? The current is going from left to right to right.
Yes, so this is a gold wire. The current's going along the wire left to right here. That's heating things up and giving various kinds of electromigration forces, and you can move atoms around that way.
Eventually. There has been something completely different, but there was a long-standing fight about the theory of electromigration. Is that resolved now? Can you explain?
I saw a March meeting talk about that this last year, and people doing various kinds of surface studies. I think Ellen Williams and people like that were able to sort of place a little bit better constraints on various kinds of electron wind versus direct electric field forces. And I think the electron wind is now understood as being the larger effect rather than direct electric field forces. But I'm not an expert in that kind of thing. That goes way back to my thesis days, too. Okay, just to explain why we have kind of a funny shaped sample, you might think about making little bridges like this. First of all, the reason we don't do that is if you sort of make magnetic devices like this, the dipole interaction between the two electrodes tend to stabilize the parallel arrangement and destabilize the anti-parallel alignment. If you want to be able to control the switch between anti-parallel and parallel arrangements, it's nice to have a shape like this, which will give a more, for which the dipole fields will stabilize the anti-parallel arrangement. Then you can just put a big field on to go parallel. But that doesn't really matter for the experiment I'll be talking about today, because we'll be applying large enough fields to saturate the moments in plane. Okay, so what do we see? Well, essentially what we'll be interested in is doing experiments where we apply a large enough field in plane to saturate the magnetic moments in both electrodes, and then look and see whether there's any dependence of the resistance on the angle of the field of the applied field in plane. So it's essentially an anisotropic magnetoresistance experiment, as opposed to thinking about what how the resistance depends on the angle between the moments in the two electrodes. And so you can start out just with one of our big devices before you do any large migration, just a few tens of ohms, you know, a big 100 nanometer kind of scale, and just look and see whether there's any kind of standard anisotropic magnetic resistance. And there is, but it's small. This is what anisotropic magnetic resistance should look like. You have the signal less than about 1% or so, which is kind of what you'd expect in this kind of geometry. So nothing too surprising there. But you can do experiments of this sort just to test how much magnetic field you need to saturate the sample. You can do the same experiment for different magnitudes of field. What we find is about above 0.5 Tesla or so, things converge and we get a nice curve that way. It's important to also do this at various steps of the process because the course of fields might change if you get down to smaller length scales as well. And we've done that, and it doesn't seem to depend too much. As one careful check, our magnet, we have a 3D vector magnet, and it will allow us to go essentially about 900 millitesla in any direction, or we can turn off the two side coils and run the center coil up to 8 tesla. And so we've gone up to 8 tesla along particular directions, and we don't see any significant change above the 0.8 tesla where we normally work. So I think we're well saturated in plane. We can't really saturate out of plane at these fields.
Mm-hmm.
No, so this is a low resistance metallic junction, a bridge about 100 nanometers across. This is just to kind of get started. And now what I'll do is I'll talk about what happens as we make the bridges smaller and smaller.
And do you see magneto, what's the effect? I mean, when you change the axis in magnetization, you get a change in the elastic properties. Do you see, so you get expansion and contraction. Do you see that?
No, what we see is we have a magnetic sample which is securely attached to a non-magnetic substrate. So it holds it in place, and we don't see magnetostriction effects. At least we can argue against that. What this is due to is the anisotropic magnetic resistance, the fact that in a magnet the resistance depends on the angle between the magnetic moment and the current.
Sure, but once you get a change in the contact area, I mean, you will get some expansion of the magnetic material, some change in its elastic properties, as you change.
So we can estimate that in terms of, you know, how much of the device could possibly be suspended, and, you know, given different magnetostriction ratio, how much would it move, and we can compare it to the most sensitive regime, which is the tunneling regime on our devices, and it's predicted that the most signal we can get from magnetostriction would be about a factor of 50 times smaller than the size of the signals we actually see. Another important thing is when people do see effects of magnetostriction and magnetostatic forces, the sign is that when they get close to the atomic size regime, what they see is sudden jumps in the resistance, typically, due to things suddenly moving around. And everything I'll show you will involve very continuous transitions. And so I think that's the best argument, that we aren't really seeing something due to magnetostriction or magnetostatic forces. But that's exactly the right question to have. You know, I want to encourage that kind of skepticism. So, so well, now what I'm going to do is just show what happens is you take a device and use electromigration to make it smaller and smaller, stop the electromigration, and then do these studies of resistance and functional angle. And so, first of all, you can make the device just a little bit smaller, make the resistance down to just a few hundred ohms. What you see there is you still keep a nice sinusoidal sort of dependence, what you'd expect to see just from bulk anisotropic magnetic resistance. The phase is a function of angle can change a little bit, the magnitude can change a little bit, but nothing too exciting happens. And the most likely explanation of what's going on there is if you look at least the test devices, what happens to electromigration is the device configuration can change, the current path can change its angle slightly. And so I think what's going on is that the angle of the device is changing slightly relative to the angle of the magnetic field here, and that can shift the phase of the AMR a bit. But again, the effect isn't too exciting there. You start seeing something a little bit interesting when you get smaller devices into the regime of, say, tens of E squared over H conductance, where you can start seeing some deviations from sinusoidal behavior in the AMR. But again, the signals still are small here, you know, just a few tenths of a percent. You go even smaller still, then you start seeing some things that get very interesting. You start seeing much bigger signals. So here is a 6 kilo ohm device. So close to the atomic scale regime, you know, a conductance quantum is about 25 kilo ohms or so in a non-magnetic device. And so here you see a signal which is, you know, bigger than 10% changes in AMR in an atomic scale device. And again, the evolution is smooth, except for one little glitch here, which is where the scan stops and starts. So that's just a little bit of drift in the amplifiers rather than a real change in the magnetic signal. The dotted line here is just a cosine squared term showing that it's quite close in this example to a sinusoidal dependence. But we also see samples in this regime which have bigger deviations from sinusoidal behavior. The effect persists into the tunneling regime as well. If you go to 4 mega ohms, where now we've broken the device to have that kind of resistance you need to be tunneling, you can still get even bigger types of AMR signals here, larger than 20% changes, again with a non-sinusoidal dependence. Okay, so in this sense, then we're getting a very large signal, comparable in magnitude to the standard tunneling magnetic resistance signal, which is the angle, the dependence of the resistance on the relative orientation of the moments in the two electrodes. But here we're keeping the electrodes moments parallel and just changing their angle together, and we're still getting 10% change in resistance.
Can't characterize the surfaces. I mean, I guess they're not very planar.
No, they're definitely not very planar. And I think that will be the key to understanding as well. I'll show you the voltage dependence here, and I think that will be the explanation of what goes on. Okay. But at this stage, I'll just pause and say that this is qualitatively similar to some of the effects we heard about this morning, gallium and manganese arsenide, this tunneling anisotropic magnetic resistance. But I think the mechanism is probably different. Here, the mechanism, at least, has been described as a dependence of the bulk density of states on the direction of the angle of magnetic moment, due to sort of spin orbit coupling in the way that K.P, band structure, is solved. I'll describe evidence here that's a little bit different mechanism in the metal device. Okay, so, just to show what the amplitude of the effect is a function of resistance. Again, in the metal regime, things are less than about a percent change. It's only when you get up above about 5,000 ohms that you get something a little bit more sizable. And if you go into the tunneling regime, things can become quite sizable. The largest we measured, I think, was 25-30% change in AMR. Okay, so what's going on? Well, what we've done very recently is extend these measurements by looking at the voltage dependence to try to get a better idea of the mechanism. And I think this helps to explain things quite a bit, but we see quite large changes in both the phase of the AMR signal and the magnitude as a function of changing the DC voltage across the device. So here we're measuring DIDB, just relative to the conductance at V equals zero, for a 470 kilo-ohm sample, well into the tunneling regime. This is just the DC, the zero bias signal done at the beginning, at the end of the sequence of measurements, so things are stable. And as we go to larger negative biases, what we see up here is the phase can change, and eventually when you get to about 50 millivolts bias, the amplitude of the signal is going down. And on the opposite side of bias, you see the same thing, changes in phase, no kind of symmetries involved. And again, by about 50 millivolts, the amplitude of the signal is going down. Perhaps even a little bit more illuminatingly, you can plot the differential conductance as a function of bias at fixed angle of magnetic field. And that's what you've shown here. At a fixed angle, the conductance shows various kinds of fluctuations, and the nature of those fluctuations depends on the angle of the applied magnetic field. But I think that's the nature of the effect. And so this then connects with an old story. It's known in non-magnetic... Yes, John?
Magnetic hysteresis as a function of bias.
No, we've looked for that, and there's no hysteresis as far as we can tell. Okay. If you just say look at the curve for one magnetic field, you can see curves of this sort with conductance fluctuations even in non-magnetic devices, both in the metallic and in the tunneling regime. And I think what's going on here is essentially the same thing. I think you have a mesoscopic effect where change in the magnetic moment affects the nature of the mesoscopic fluctuation. And I'll talk about that more in a minute. Just to kind of show you a little bit nicer data as well, here's a different sample, again in the tunneling regime, about 260 kilo-ohms. Again, the differential conductance versus voltage, showing how the nature of the conductance fluctuations here depend on the angle of the applied magnetic field. And you can make the kind of color plots people like to make in these fields. Here I'm plotting in this color the differential conductance minus the average conductance at fixed voltage, taking account the overall average voltage depends on voltage, overall conductance depends on voltage as well. And you can see all kinds of fluctuations which change their phase and magnitude as you change the field angle and the DC voltage applied. Okay, so what is the mechanism? As I said, the voltage dependence really has the flavor of a mesoscopic conductance fluctuation. I think that leads to a simple picture. I think what you want to think about here in this kind of tunneling measurement is the local density of states contributing to tunneling. And I think what the measurements show is that the local density of states has lots of fluctuations you would expect, and that the new ingredient is that the fluctuations depend on what the direction of the magnetic moment is. That makes sense. Due to spin orbit coupling, the pattern of fluctuations can change when the moment rotates, and that can change the orbital pattern of the electron. So I think it's essentially just simple Fidel oscillations, but with coupling to the magnetic moment through spin orbit coupling. And just to give credit where it's due, in non-magnetic samples, a similar effect has been measured about 15 years ago by Philip Holvig in metal point contacts, and also Alex Van Udenarden, I apologize for the pronunciation, but you know, I'm from Kentucky, did the same thing in tunnel junction. Very recently also, I should give credit to Drago Davidovich and his group. They've looked at about 100 nanometer scale cobalt disks, about 10 nanometers thick, and did a more standard kind of UCF type measurement. And again, they saw fluctuations as a function of sweeping a magnetic field along one direction that would then orient, give domain structure and then reorient the magnet. So the only new feature going on here, as I said, that what's going on here is that it seems that these conductance fluctuations are not modified just by the magnetic flux, which people have studied for years in conductance fluctuations. That's too small an effect in these very small geometries to have anything like a flux quantum through the effective area. But it seems to be the stronger effect from reorienting the exchange field and then having that act on the electron orbital motion through the spin orbit coupling. There's been one calculation of this effect by Pete Brower and Shafiq Adam and their collaborators in connection with the Dragovich experiment, where they've argued that this this reorientation of the exchange field should be a stronger effect than the direct magnetic flux by about a factor of 5 in this geometry, in the vivid geometry, and probably even a larger factor in our point contact geometry.
Are these sort of basically the first observations of mesoscopic phase coherent effects in semiconductors?
A few years ago, there was an Arnoff-Bohm experiment that I should know the reference off the top of my head, but I don't.
Was that believed? Japanese group.
Yeah.
A few papers. But I guess everyone was very skeptical about that.
They make ferromagnetic reads
Yes, I don't know how skeptical we are about that. I mean, there's a question about what is the phase coherence length in these devices. From this experiment, it seems, in order to fit the data, that it needs to be quite small. So I don't know to what extent you could actually think about extending a ring and making something large. It also seems from our experiment that if you go to larger voltage, the fluctuation seems to die off rather more quickly in the magnetic devices rather than the non-magnetic devices. And that would also point to sort of a shorter dephasing time, I think.
Any idea why the dephasing time is so short?
I don't. Okay. Also want to make contact to one other related experiment, which appeared about simultaneously with ours from Ray's group. They did a rather similar experiment, except they had a slightly different device geometry, which isn't so clear to me. They also had pure materials. So this is the pure iron, that's what this data is, and also the other transition metals, but pure materials at low temperature and in somewhat larger magnetic field, and then they rotated the magnetic field in their experiments and looked and see what they saw. Their experiments agree with ours, and they see quite large changes in the function of the magnetic field, but the qualitative, there are qualitative differences. Definitely, they see quite large jumps as they sweep the field, which we don't see. In our devices, they've just shown sort of continuous behavior here. So they've looked, again, over the whole range. These particular devices are not in the tunneling regime. They're in the few atom contact regime. But they have also looked at higher resistance as well and seen even larger effects than we've seen. So these kinds of sudden changes are quite interesting, particularly because there's been previous theory suggesting a nice way this could come about, that in these kinds of magnetic devices, when you're down to just a few atomic channels, as you rotate the magnetic moment, it might be possible to pinch off particular transport channels and get changes of conductance in a sharp way that way. That was done by Velov et al. From the Nebraska group. And also, Beret's group did calculations associated with their experiment, which indicated something of the same thing.
Probably the jumps being integers.
Not necessarily, I think, depending on sort of how much, what the transmission coefficients were for that particular mode. That, if they're not unity, you wouldn't get a unity jump.
But they didn't calculate that.
That's my understanding, too. So I want to show you this just because, well, it's different than ours, and I'm not entirely sure why. There are somewhat different experiments, and I do want to go back and look not at permolloy devices, but some pure magnetic materials in our devices, too, to see whether there is any significant difference. Of course, as I suggest to you, I think the default reaction should be to be skeptical about mechanical instabilities. In particular, if you look at the symmetries of devices, the resistance isn't symmetric upon reversing the magnetic field by turning it by 180 degrees, which is often a sign that you have some sort of instabilities that can give hysteresis and jumpiness in that way. But you know, I'm not sure what the real difference in these experiments are.
Is the last reference theory that you read?
This is theory, and then this is the experimental reference.
Is this a spin orbit coupling for a single chain?
Or it's a narrow contact of just a few channels.
Just one-dimensional.
One-dimensional, okay.
One-dimensional infinite calculation that just look what is occupied. It's not.
Look at it, it's 700 ohms. I mean, it's
calculation.
Yeah, but it's many, many channels.
So here there's nothing really jumpy going on either. Here, you have an 8,000 ohm device, and here it's 16,000 ohms. So they're close to subatomic dimensions.
Did you, in your samples, observe anything like conductance quantization?
Not that we could see.
A few atom regimes or something?
No. We don't have a huge number of statistics of the sort to build up histograms and things like that in that regime. But with the statistics we have available, there's really nothing obvious there. It's one of the brief point to mention briefly is these fluctuations also do have other effects. In particular, they give large fluctuations in the standard tunneling magnetic resistance as well, just the resistance change you get by switching between parallel and antiparallel alignment. One way you can show that is we can take the same device in the tunneling regime, and by applying a large voltage, we can still move the atoms around a little bit, even the tunneling regime, and give a slightly different resistance. And when we do that, often we'll get much bigger changes in the tunneling magnetic resistance than in the overall resistance. So this is all one device, just sweeping between parallel and antiparallel alignment. As we rearrange the atoms slightly, the overall switching fields don't change very much, but the magnetic resistance can change from almost 80% even down to negative values as we produce small changes in the tunneling gap. And again, I think the explanation is just small mesoscopic fluctuations in resistance that can depend exactly where every atom is. If you change that slightly, you'll change those mesoscopic fluctuations, and you can get different tunneling rates because of that.
So these are really changes in atomic configurations?
I believe so, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you can't freeze them? You said some time ago, you said you go to low temperatures to stop that happening, but...
So these curves are all reproducible as long as we stay at low temperatures and don't apply a high voltage. So we can sweep over the same one over and over again. So there's nothing time-dependent happening in that sense. But then if we go to high voltage, move the atoms around a little bit, come back down, things have reshuffled and changed around. If we try to take our sample, start at low temperatures and warm it up and warm it back down, that's very bad. The samples don't survive that.
Yeah, I mean, we did some calculations on planar junctions, and you get very large spreading configurations, so in the TMO.
Mm-hmm.
So you are very sensitive to the exact configurations of some configurations.
Yeah, so I think that's not a surprise. I think here it's just showing that there are mesoscopic effects in addition to the ones that people normally think about in terms of just simple atomistic calculations that can come in and have a rather significant impact too. Okay, so that's the story then. I'll just leave these up, and I think I'll take questions if there are any more questions.
As you mean by having essentially the, when you change the orientation of the magnetic moment, the local density of states from one wave vector to another wave vector that you channel through, you pick different ones and they have very different tunneling probabilities.
I might have a little bit too simplistic a picture, but I would think about, say, the tunneling measurement is probing essentially the local density of states on those two sides, and those local density of states can depend on where each atom it is, and also what the orientation moment is, because it's a strongly fluctuating quantity, and it depends on all these variables.
Okay. I'm trying to think of why it's different from what we were doing. Because in the other beyond just Lorentz experiment, the other experiment was done in Galton-Nath, where in the nanostructures constrictions were actually the pinch of it was actually going continuously from AMR to 3AMR by doing gates. Have you seen those? And their analysis, we tried to understand it from the point of view. Say, look, you know, just think of, because now you actually have only a few nanometers, 1 or 2 nanometers, so you actually have some selection of wave vectors that you're allowed on the bands, and then looking at how the tunnel probability changes, and it could be very drastic, so that could be some of the origins, and it's related to the AMR. You can obviously see the AMR continuously going into the TAMR, but why would that be a different mechanism?
Yes, I think the difference in the mechanism would just be a distinction about whether it's a bulk density of states effect or whether it's a local density of states effect.
Well, local density meaning of right at the, mm-hmm. I think it's a local, even in the Lorentz experiment, it has to be local.
And then to what extent the local density state is different than the bulk density?
Yeah, I mean, the calculations that Thomas did of just trying to explain qualitatively the experiments of Lorentz, that was only for the regime. Nobody goes to very low temperatures when these things go crazy, it's 100,000%, but we're just mainly to see the possibility of that there was PAMR. But certainly it has to be, look, it has to be only a few. The things close to the tunneling, that has to be looking for.
But then it's whether in the regime you're dealing with, whether there are quantum interference effects that make that make the local density state a fluctuating quantity, or whether it's just local density state is simply equal to the bulk.
Yeah, so in that second paper we had those quantum interference effects because of Landau-Budiker calculation, looking at the different orientations, and you could see quite drastic, changes by doing the change.
But you're still calculating bulk densities.
No, not a wire. So it was a wire with a finite size, if I remember correctly.
But it was an infinite periodic.
But we're looking at it in terms of the location of the path of the time probability of the Fermi surface, or the Fermi sea. And then you say, okay, look at the time probability at different k vectors, which would be in another constriction, mesoscopic constriction, right? You would pick a certain wave vectors. That's what you mean, I think, by local. I'm not sure.
Other questions or comments? Otherwise, I'm keeping some cookies, I think. So.
Thank you.